On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
You have this kind of asymmetrical warfare coming from a guy who's great at a soundbite, lousy at an answer.
So are you looking for your own billionaire?
Nope. No, I don't want my own billionaire. I'm going to raise the vast majority of the money.
Brace yourself, America, for what?
King Trump.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I think of the idea of really emotionally intense comedy, and there's probably nobody better at it than my guest, the man sitting across from me right now, Taika Waititi.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Of course, you know him from Eagle and Shark and one of my favorite films, Boy. His new film is...
Hunt for the Wilder People. I was going to say What We Do in the Shadows, so I had a flashback to it like
No, that was a couple of years ago. Yeah. We should have had you in for that.
Well, I was going to say both so that you can use this anytime you want.
No. We'll use it sometime in the next 10 years.
I'll say some random other titles.
I mentioned films from 10 years ago, so we can get to everything you've done. But first of all, thanks so much for doing the show, Taika.
Thank you for having me. Huge fan of yours.
God, that's so nice. I'm a big fan of yours as well, as you know from our mutual friend, Rowena, and first of us being in contact a couple of times. But the idea this making this comedy that's almost like fairy tale comedy and like Brothers Grimm of Hans Christian Andersen, really emotionally intense comedy. Where does that come from for you?
I think an emotionally intense but funny life. You know, I feel like my background is quite varied, and I grew up in a very small community with a lot of poverty and a lot of intense situations when I was a kid. But also, you know, you have to. I think most cultures and most people, when they're faced with, you know, dark and adverse situations, comedy is the thing that gets you through. You know, it certainly got me through as a kid. And I grew up on a huge diet of British comedies and America, you know, the best of both worlds, really. You know, we had a strong influence from both America and the UK and a little bit of Australia.
What were some of the American things that they were?
Growing up in the 80s, it was like MASH, Different Strokes.
So television, American
television. A lot of American television. Yeah, we grew up on a steady diet of American and British TV. Yeah.
And which were some of the British shows for you?
Fawlty Towers, Blackadder.
Blackadder.
All the classics.
Oh, my God.
Young ones. And it's interesting, definitely people here in the States know Blackadder. Not so many know Fawlty Towers, and definitely nobody knows Young Ones.
Young Ones, because that's funny, because that ran on MTV for a bit here in the 80s.
Right.
And that's that kind of really, that sort of... that sort of intersection, sort of rundown world and really sort of extreme reaction to things is very much what you do.
Even today, that show is still so unique and so original. You know, suddenly they just cut to, and now the specials. And the specials would be there playing a song, and then they cut back to the story, and it was so madcap. And yeah, and I think my sense of humor developed, you know, from that kind of... You know, it's not specifically American style or a British style. It's like Rhys Darby and I often talk about New Zealand comedy and how to define it. And I think we said it's the comedy of the mundane, where because we come from a small town country, really. You know, the country is a small town on the planet, and you're sort of forced to just be entertained by the dregs that you get, sort of, you know, the scraps at the dinner table, really, that from the rest of the world. We were always the last people to get the movies, you know. It's like E.T. would come out in the States and we'd get it like 6 months later. And it always drove me crazy because everyone was talking, you know, you'd be watching TV and they'd always be talking about these great movies and we could never watch them. It always felt like, you know, we were sort of like the last frontier on Earth, and we were the last ones to get anything. And I think, you know, in that sense, like the way we developed our comedy was we talk about the most boring things until it's funny, and then we keep talking and then it becomes unfunny, and then we keep talking about it until it becomes funny again. And that's sort of like I think our style.
It's funny because as you're talking about these things, so much of what you've done as a creator is about people who are a little behind the curve. I mean, you're mm-hmm. your protagonist in Hunt for the Wilder People, still he talks about Tupac being his best friend.
Yeah.
And then the characters from What We Do in the Shadows are almost
they're very much in the past.
But are fixated on that. They can't really get past that. Mm-hmm. You could really say that about Eagle versus Shark or Boy as well, couldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, Jermaine's character in Eagle versus Shark is a guy in his mid 30s who's still trying to get revenge on his high school bully, and I think also like a lot of the technology I put into my films, I never use the latest technology because it dates so fast. Like if you watch The Matrix, that Nokia phone that he has, the kind of like flip my phone that he has, I mean, it's a funny thing to see now. So my theory is you should put things in that are already obsolete, and then it's sort of, you make fun of that, you know.
That becomes a big plot point in Wilder People, too, that idea, that technology. It's also the kind of technology you expect the authorities to have. They wouldn't have the latest technology anyway, would they?
They never do, especially in New Zealand. there's actually this thing in Wilder People where I called it Stingray. I actually spelt it Stungray, S-T-U-N-G, because everyone thinks that whenever we say the letter I, it sounds like a U, like fush and chups. Like that's the New Zealand accent. So the Stingray machine is actually a thing. I did some research. So I was like, how would you locate a cell phone out in the wilderness? Like, how would the authorities do it? And they have a way. So they set up like a fake cell tower, a portable one, and it, and if there's a phone that's on, it'll think that it's a network and latch on, and then they can cross reference point, on a map to the location. So it was actually great finding out that, because I was like, how are these guys going to get caught? How do the police find them?
Well, this is probably a point where you get to tell the audience what the movie's about a little bit. And it's about a lot.
I am the worst at telling anyone what my film's about. Okay, so it's about a... We've got 13 more minutes until a 10-second break, and then I'll get it right. So the film centers around a 12-year-old foster kid and an old man who's sort of like his foster uncle, who are on the run from the authorities, and in particular a social welfare worker who's hell-bent on putting this kid back into the foster care system.
She's basically Mrs. Hannigan from...
Yeah, she's also Tommy Lee Jones from The Fugitive. I said, you should just play Tommy Lee Jones. That's your character.
She almost reminds a little bit also the social worker from Moonrise Kingdom a little bit, too.
Oh, yeah. Tilda's one, yeah.
Yeah.
So then it's basically a kind of intense fun adventure with these two, this sort of odd couple, this like short, fat Māori kid and this cantankerous, skinny old white guy on the run.
Played by an iconic action actor. This is the one of the stars of Jurassic Park.
That's right. Sam Neill also played Damien in Omen 3.
Let's not remind him of that.
One of my favorite lines, I kept saying it to him, I think it drove him crazy, was his final line in Omen 3 was because he plays, whatever, the devil, and he, son of the devil. And he, I remember he's like standing in front of like the cross, like Jesus on the cross in a church, and I remember his lines. He's just like wounded, mortally wounded, and he says, "You have won nothing." And then he collapses. And I'd say that to him every day. Sam, you have won nothing.
That will explain a lot about the performance. But I think one of the things that also works its way through your stuff as well is there's a character who's obsessed with self-image and think of themselves as things that they actually are not.
Yes, exactly. You can see that in all of my films.
Yeah.
And I think that it's because, I'm fascinated by... Jermaine always makes fun of me for it, but I'm fascinated by
people.
You mean
Jermaine Clant with him? Yeah. We've worked a few times.
So Jermaine says that I'm obsessed with the idea of people who want to be cool. Because I'm very interested in the idea of coolness and like what it is and like what it is to be cool. And my realization when I was making Eagle versus Shark is that nobody's actually cool. There's probably a handful. Prince is cool. There's not many. But there are like some cool people, but for the most part, the rest of us are deeply uncool, and we spend our lives striving for coolness, and that motivates us in a lot of the things we do, and it motivates a lot of my characters trying to achieve some sense of like trying to be a hero. I think that's a really great human trait, and I love seeing characters like that who are struggling for recognition and struggling to come out of the shadows.
But that idea of making that into comedy, it really makes the characters that much more vivid, people who really have this belief in kind of this one thing. ultra focused. All these characters that you create.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting. You're talking about the kind of fairy tale nature of it. I mean, especially with wilder people, it's
but Boy as well, I think.
And Boy as well. I mean, yeah, they're all kind of fantasy films set in reality. I mean, there's no reality in which a social welfare worker would be able to spearhead an operation, like, you know, a manhunt, and it's like controlling the police and the army. And yeah, and this is this character that she's doing it. And people don't really ask that question. How come she's got all this power? She's just a social welfare worker. But it doesn't matter. No one cares. And it's like about creating the excitement in the world. And yeah, and you need a villain, and you need the person who's on the run, and you need the crazy Rhys Darby kind of character, and all these things are kind of a little bit in the book because adapted from a book,
but only a little bit in the book. I mean, you only basically use the book as a taking out point, because I dug the book about, wow, this is, you really just sort of use the sort of a bit of the premise of the book and just completely take off from there.
That's right. The book is not. I mean, there's no real humor in the book. It's, you know, it's very much just diary entries from this little boy and just. And very matter of fact,
you can get a sense of other people in the book so much.
No. And it's not even, there's not even a lot of character development. It's just, he just says, and then this happened, and then this happened. But it's a fascinating read. And it's, I think a lot of New Zealanders definitely, when I was growing up, read that book and, you know, were carried away with the idea of, you know, being on the run and helicopters looking for you and, you know, and being ahead of the chase. And I wanted to capture that feeling again. And take just the essence of the book, being on the run, and that bond that, you know, that forms between the old man and the boy. And I wanted to take it and run with it and turn it into a New Zealand, an Australasian 80s action film.
But playing it completely for comedy is something that's not in the book at all.
No, that's right. I actually originally adapted it in about 2005, and it was very serious. My first draft was very serious, and people were shot, people died, and there's all sorts of, you know, it was a lot darker, much more of an arty film. And then I went off and made three other features, and I came back to it and I thought, I don't want to make a film like that. I want to make a film that people really love and want to, you know, like, that celebrates the New Zealand adventurous spirit and, you know, like, in the spirit of the book. And also, like, I think over the years I've realized that there's an old saying about from like the clowning world, where they talk about how the audience is king, and that it's like you're performing for the king, and you have to entertain them. And if they don't like what you do, or if they don't get it, then it's your fault. You know, because a lot of artists, if they don't get it, they're dumb. You know, they just don't understand my work, or they don't understand my vision. But I start, you know, as I get older, and you know, I have kids, and start thinking, no, I think the clowns were right. I think you do have to work to get an audience to understand what you're doing. And I think you start getting nearer to higher art when it doesn't matter the background of the audience or who's looking at the painting. If they're affected by it without having to read the blurb about the painting and having, you know, I don't think art needs to have an explanation like that. If it hits you on some level, then it's working. And I'm trying more and more in my work to reach more people and not to kind of be a snob about my work. It just annoys me now because it's just like it's associated with intellectualism and the sort of being smarter than an audience and you know, confusing an audience, and like, oh, it's like, let's just shock them. And, you know, they won't get it, but they'll be shocked. It's this idea that, like, you know, that creating art has to be an intense, grueling process, and it's all, you know, and like that
for the audience,
serious
for the audience and for the artist,
and for the artist as well. It's all about the artist, like the way that he came up with the thing. It's like, oh, and then I use my blood to make a painting, and you know, and guess what? I've done that. I've been that person, and it's not fun. It's boring, and now I just want to entertain people and not take things so seriously.
That's probably a great point to take a break. I'm talking to the director of Hunt for the Wilder People. Wilder People. It's hard to say. That's the art is just saying the title of the movie.
It is. Well, yeah, it comes from Wilder Beasts. I know, when you look at it, it looks like, you know, a lot of people say, oh,
looks like
Wilder.
About Gene Wilder, yes, but it's not about that. We'll take a break. There's more to come. Stay with us.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're talking about a number of things with my guests, Taika Waititi, including his new film, Hunt for the Wilder People. See, I could get it out during the second part of the show. But one of the things I was saying to you just during the break is that the characters, in some way, think of themselves as being artists or bigger-than-life people. And that makes these bigger-than-life stories, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that every human is an artist in some way. You know, I think from whether you like it or not, you're here to create something. And, you know, whether it be children or whether it be a kitchen or whether it be a cake or a pair of jeans, you know, you're here to make stuff and obviously live and eat. But that's not the point of it. The point of it is to further your soul and let it continue on and evolve. And I think, like, the goal of human, like, what's the meaning of life is to try and get immortality, and that's sort of what I think deep down what we want. And I think artists achieve that. A lot of them don't, 99% of them don't, but a lot of the ones who do, if it's strong enough, if their art is strong enough, they live on and on and on in their work. And I think we all love that idea of being immortal through, like, that, leaving something behind and, like, you know, this legacy. I mean, you know, one of my favorite of all time artists just passed away, David Bowie. You know, the legacy that he's left behind, not only in music, but also in, like, his art and even his acting. You know, he's a dream for many people, especially in this industry, in the entertainment industry, is to achieve some level of immortality by being liked and being cool. And I think Prince and Bowie, the two coolest people, and Freddie Mercury.
One of the things I keep thinking about is the way you use the exteriors in your piece. Exterior spaces are always really important to you. And is that just part and parcel of coming up where you spent a lot of time outside? But these exteriors, be it people being afraid of them in shadows or sort of luxuriating them in the way they do in Boy or in Eagle versus Shark, that outside space is really important to you, isn't it?
It's so New Zealand as well. It's, you know, you spend all your time outside in New Zealand. As a kid, you know, you'd be kicked out of the house and you wouldn't be allowed back in until nighttime. And so, you know, your whole world is outside because, you know, New Zealand is essentially a rural nation. You know, there are a couple of cities, but for the most part, it's a very rural environment. And shooting a film there, it's almost impossible to not see something beautiful in the landscape. You know, if you just turn the camera on and it's there, and the light is always, there's a very different light in New Zealand as well, very different.
And you like using that light too, don't you?
Yeah, it's a very crisp, kind of a clean light. Like, the light here in LA is beautiful, the smoggy kind of diffused light is, you know, and that whole, like, Punch Drunk Love, the beginning of Punch Drunk Love, in fact, most of the film is it's beautiful because, like, Peter Hands perfectly captures the LA light, I think, in his films. And he grew up here, and that's what he knows. And, you know, I mean, you know, can make the valley look beautiful. It's an achievement. So, you know, for me, like, you know, in New Zealand, it's like I have to kind of show it. You know, I think it's there. I have to show it off. And I'm not into, like, the sort of, oh, it's a postcard for New Zealand. It's like tourism. It's just what it looks like. And, you know, I like putting broken, clumsy characters in the middle of these beautiful, perfect environments and kind of stumble and bumble around and bump into each other.
Well, something I mentioned to you about a New Zealand film that a lot of people may not know about, but they should know, the film Smash Palace. I'm like, gosh, almost 40 years ago now. But I couldn't help but notice the visual similarities, not to mention even Sam Neill's character, between that film and yours.
Yeah, I actually feel that this film is a bit of a love note. Not a letter, like a love memo. There are a lot of love tweets in this film. There are a lot of those little references to not only New Zealand films, but also Australian films. Even in the way that it's shot, like I purposefully put in a lot of zooms that I think Peter Weir is.
Oh, mastered. God, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The Peter Weir zoom is, you know, it's not easy to do, but you'll notice in the film there's a lot of. The camera zooms in towards a character and then drifts off past there, you know, off into the distance and defocuses and then it goes all soft and beautiful. So, yeah, a lot of dissolves and a lot of, I guess, a lot of stylistic things that are quite uncool now. You know, people are sort of maybe starting to use again in a kind of ironic way. But I think, for instance, I think zoom shots are great. I think they're beautiful. And used well, the zoom is a great tool. You know, I think the trend nowadays is to like do little pop zooms, like it's a sort of documentary kind of boof, 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 and you know, it's like, oh, suddenly a close up.
But your films are really incredibly formal in that way.
Yeah, 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 absolutely. I hardly ever use handheld because, again, I think it's a trend.
Yeah, actually, when you talk about something that seems dated, when you see films from a certain period, especially a lot of the handheld, it's just sort of screaming to you what year it was.
Sometimes you need it, it's just fast and it's like efficient, and it's like, okay, well, from a practical point of view, I have to do this. Like Shadows, we shot so fast and it was all improvised. So the entire film is handheld.
But it's also, you want to create that kind of intimacy with that film too.
Yeah. I mean, it's, the camera's right there and, you know, with everything panning around and just trying to capture, you know, all the conversations, quite informal in that sense. But also talking about, some of the stylistic things in the film. And yeah, so this, it dissolves and even the music, like a little kind of synth music throughout the film, a bit, you know, my kind of Gallipoli-ish kind of, you know, my like, I actually, like, we actually sent an email to Jean-Michel Jarre's people because I wanted to,
Do
you want to do the score? I want you to do the score for this film.
What did he say?
He was busy working on another album. And so he couldn't do it or wasn't interested. I don't blame him. But but the Phoenix Foundation, who I collaborate with on all my stuff, they did a great score for the film. But yeah, then throughout, you know, like you mentioned Smash Palace. So that's a, you know, very iconic New Zealand film. You know, there's a big showdown which takes place in Smash Palace, which is like the actual location of the showdown at the end of Smash Palace. We didn't use the same place. It's like little kind of, what do you call them? The you know, when they put them in films, those little things for the fans. For
the Easter eggs.
Easter eggs. The little kind of New Zealand and Australian Easter eggs sort of things. Yeah, and then Sam Neill was in Sleeping Dogs, which is, you know, he's on the run from the law. And so he's basically like his character again is now on the run again.
Yeah, that was in some ways, it reminds me a little bit of The Car They'd Paris.
Oh, yeah. That one's crazy.
I know.
I mean, there's definitely like a, you know, like there's some Mad Max influences in the car chase. Not Fury Road so much because I hadn't seen that when we shot the car chase, but definitely from the earlier Mad Max films and a lot of those
Australian car movies.
What do they call it?
Exploitation films. We just had George Miller here a couple of weeks ago, and I was talking to him about those films. And I mentioned Car They'd Paris.
Hands down, one of the great. I mean, you got to hand it to that guy. To have an oeuvre as eclectic and as varied as his is incredible.
But yours is pretty varied too.
Well, that's what's inspiring to me. Yeah. There's artists like that, like, you know, and also obviously Harold Ashby. You can't find, you know, two Harold Ashby films that are alike. You know,
or for that matter, Peter Weir. I mean, he's the guy who made like car movies or
Master Commander. Yeah. It's great. It's a great, great film.
Or Picnic at Hanging Rock. Those different kinds of films. And that idea, that the thing that links you to Miller, I think, and to Peter Weir too, is again, or even to Smash Palace, which is a film that it's so melodramatic, it could almost be a comedy because it's so big and so emotional.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and that's what the films were like in those days for us. You know, New Zealand made a lot of action films in the 80s. Battle Truck, crazy, weird.
That's one of the weirdest movies ever made.
Yes,
it's so strange.
It is. And for no reason at all. And also similar to the Blues Brothers, you know, which was a great, great, crazy film. For no reason at all, you'd have to, you know, there'd be a car chase and you'd have to flip a police car. And I thought, you know what? You've got to flip a police car. Let's do it. And so we did it in this film. And for no reason at all, other than you have to if you're going to do these kind of films. Yeah, so there's all those sorts of things that we thought, you know, you've got to, if we're going to do this kind of film, we have to do that.
Well, we're talking intensity with my guest, Taika Waititi, whose new film is Hunt for the Wilder People. See, I can keep doing this.
You're getting so good at this.
I won't be able to say anything else after a while, but I can say that. But you were talking about that comedy of the mundane, and that really is also those comedies you like. I mean, Young Ones or Fawlty Towers, you don't get more about the mundane than that. I mean, Basil throwing a fit about room service. I mean, that's really pretty mundane comedy.
And it keeps going. He keeps going and going. You know, like, that's the great thing about those comedies is that, well, there's a few great things about them. There's only six of them per season. They don't overdo it. And they don't overcomplicate it. I mean, those structurally, the faulty towers, there's a lot going on in them, but they're very, very simple. And they leave enough room for John Cleese to, or for any of the actors to, like, just to go for it and to, like, spend way too much time on one joke. But it's perfect, you know, and I think that's it's a good lesson to keep things simple.
No, but you were talking during the break too, because you made a mention to a painting with your own blood, and I'm guessing that even as an artist, you led a pretty intense life, didn't you? Like, a lot, the idea of an emotional investment, be it for comedy or whatever, is key to the way you think as a creative person, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that my background is painting and visual art, so I started off doing that, and I mean, I was doing a lot of different things at the same time, working a lot in theater and making, writing plays and
well, a lot of your sets
stuff.
Are almost like theaters, like almost like there's almost like a percentage of
March
set.
I mean, I did theater for maybe 15, 16 years before I made my first film, so. I mean, there's a lot of the kind of proscenium kind of
absolutely,
angles, and
sure.
It's like very presented, you know. And I, I really love that style. I love sitting back. I love wide angle. I love wide shots. I don't use them probably enough, but I love letting things play out. Especially when I'm shooting, I let things play out a lot. And
single
I
takes,
often feel
yeah.
like, oh man, I would just love to put this big long wide shot in the movie, but you know, pacing wise, you got to change it, and you got to kind of sometimes you lose those great scenes, but. But I'm a big fan of that, and I think that comes from definitely from the theatre and in the old days no one would put any of us in their plays in the nice theatres, so we'd go off to these underground theatres and make our own plays and put each other in them, and we'd make our own props and put on our own shows. And I think that's being rejected from like the acting scene was actually the best thing for us. We started becoming more autonomous and we started doing all the jobs, instead of just acting, we were writing, directing each other, acting, making the props, designing the sets, putting the shows, designing the stupid posters, selling tickets. we did everything. And I think that's is probably been the best thing for us. And definitely that's where the comedy was allowed to flourish and this development of the style.
But also figuring out that thing too, that you talk about making stuff for the audience, but at some point you're doing this kind of stuff in your own company. You're doing it for just to amuse yourselves and see how far you can go, aren't you?
Yeah, and I think what's good about having, I'm 40 now, I can say this is a career, but I've never really had a job. I can't even say filmmaking is a job because it's so enjoyable, and I equate work with pain. So I don't feel like I work. I feel like I've been tricking a lot of people along the way, and that I get to go and pretend stuff and make jokes and make things that I think are funny and cool, and then people like say, "Oh, you're good at your job." And I'm like, "This is not a job," but I mean, we've always done things that we find funny. That you've got to please yourself first. And I believe that, when you're first starting off, you're like, oh, man, who's going to like this? If my voice or my vision is, if no one's going to like it? But I think, I think, like, at this stage, I believe that what I'm doing has an audience.
Well, we're out of time. Will you come back again, please?
Sure. When?
next
one.
Make a movie. Do that. Well, thanks so much for doing this, Taika. Really, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. My guest is Taika Waititi, whose new film is
Hunt
for
the
Wilder People. I knew I can get this right. A recording engineer here at NPR West is Marcia Caldwell. The show is mixed by Kat Yoris, edited by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. I don't have a career either. It's the treatment. Shake it, don't break it. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.